Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University. Please make sure you like, comment, and subscribe on today's video. Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University. And we're back. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. Every week, we talk about how to love ourselves, others, and a higher nature, how to improve our finances, career, health, relationships, and spirituality. And we have a very distinguished guest for today, Elizabeth Benedict. She's a best-selling novelist and National Book Award finalist. She authored the classic book on sex and fiction, The Joy of Writing Sex. She has written reviews and articles for New York Times, Boston Globe, and Esquire. And she has taught creative writing at Princeton and Columbia, among other places. She's also a cancer survivor and the author of the book Rewriting Illness, A View of My Own. And she also lives in New York City. Welcome, Elizabeth, to the show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Good. Now, you have a very fascinating book. I was reading this book, Rewriting Illness. And the first thing that came to my mind is, why do you use the term rewriting illness? What is the theme behind that?
Well, the idea is that when I was going through my illness, which I'll talk about more in a minute or two, but when I was going through it, I was sort of a puddle of fear and ignorance, and I sort of didn't know what the outcome would be. And so I just was sort of blundering through it, let's say. And when I decided to write about it, I could see it. I could see what happened to me, and I could see my experience kind of through a different lens of time and distance. And so I was sort of rewriting it in that way. I was telling the story of my illness, but not from a blow-by-blow account of what it was actually like to go through, although there is quite a lot of that, but I intersperse it with other things to sort of relieve some of the tension.
I see. Okay. You had an interesting perspective on this whole illness. Now, the other thing that's interesting about you is that you say you're a hypochondriac, which is kind of someone that is afraid of certain illnesses or sicknesses. And you also mentioned you're afraid of planes, but at the same time, you said there are a lot of things you're not afraid of. You said you're not afraid of, I think it was public speaking, blank pages, writing about sex, conflict, and other things. So tell me about the fear part of this. How did that work into this thing?
Well, I start the book talking about a girl in my high school class who died of lymphoma. This was in 1972. And I went to a high school for 2 years that was very, very small. There were 22 girls in my entire grade. And when this one girl died, it was quite traumatic for all of us. And she came to school one day and said, you know, there's a lump over here. And she was dead several months later. Oh. And so that that kind of rewired my nervous system. And whenever I had a swollen lymph node or I had a bump anywhere, I figured I would be dead in a few months. So I think it affected a lot of people in our class. It was just all girls school, and we gathered in this little tiny room. And so all of that experience, plus, you know, some of my own family genes and experiences conspired to make me hyper aware and hyper nervous about situations where I thought my life would be in danger. And flying is sort of is one where you would often think that. Many people feel that, but also the fear of illness. So I was terribly afraid of being sick, and I was afraid of getting cancer. And I'm a freelance writer, and I've always had to buy my own health insurance. And even when I've been very broke and haven't had a lot of extra cash, I've always made sure that I had health insurance. I mean, I don't think I had a day of my adult life without health insurance because I had so many fears about being sick.
Interesting. Now, you're a very accomplished writer. I used a word here. I didn't even know what it was. It sounded nice when I read it. It's called evanescent. And I'm thinking of like something like illumination, but actually it's vanishing. Mm-hmm. You're saying that as soon as you discovered, I guess, the lump, you said, I guess your joy vanished. Your husband was in the other room of more than 20 years. And then all of a sudden everything changed. Tell us about that moment.
I had been feeling something a little strange around the area of my shoulder armpit for a few weeks, but it wasn't constant and it didn't hurt. And it was very vague. And I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't tell my husband about it. And one night at 11 o'clock, I was in my living room and I was in a very good mood. We had just had a really nice friend for dinner. And I said, you know, let me just check this out. And I put my hand under my arm and I felt this very distinct lump of the kind you don't want to feel and that I'd never felt before. And so that was sort of the beginning of this odyssey with the medical industrial establishment. And I guess, you know, as a woman, we are supposed to do self-breast exams every month and we get mammograms every year. And people are always prodding and poking our bodies to make sure we don't have cancer or to find out if we do have cancer. So women are very hyper aware of what it means when you have a lump. And I suppose men are too, but men don't go through exactly these procedures regularly. So I was stunned as though I'd stuck my finger in a light socket. And I just sat there for a while wondering what to do. It was 11 o'clock at night, not a great time to call the doctor. And it wasn't like an emergency that you'd need an ambulance for, right? I knew that. And so I bravely looked up lump in armpit and I saw that it could be one of three things. One was breast cancer. And sometimes breast cancer starts in the armpit. It starts somewhere beside the breast. It could be a cyst. Or it could be a blood cancer, like lymphoma. And so the two out of the three were not great, you know. And I went to the doctor immediately. Literally, I called the doctor at 9 o'clock in the morning and went to the doctor at noon. And I thought I would have an answer in a few days. And I should have had an answer in a few days. But it took 3 months for a crazy variety of reasons to be diagnosed with something that was really very evident from the beginning.
Yes.
So I think it took 3 months to be diagnosed. It took 4 months to actually see a doctor, an oncologist who treated me. And I think if I hadn't, and so I encountered all kinds of sort of puzzling doctors and puzzling ways that doctors speak and puzzling ways that doctors put you off and dismiss you and send you to other doctors and often don't do the thing that's sort of right in front of them that they should be doing. And so I had a lot of time to think about all those things. I had a lot of time to think about what it meant to maybe being deathly ill. And then when I was actually finally diagnosed, it was unclear what the outcome would be. And I think that I had a mutated gene that even though the kind of lymphoma I had is considered treatable and the gene that I had, which they do at another level of testing, said that I might not respond to the chemo. And my doctor was very concerned that I might not respond to the chemo. And so it was really, the outcome for all of this was uncertain, even though the kind I had was treatable. And the thing about cancer and I guess other illnesses, but let's just stick with cancer for the moment. It can always come back. You know, cancer is a dagger and it's a boomerang, right? And you have to wait years, literally, to see whether it comes back. And in my case, the first 2 years of it, whether it comes back or not, are key. And if it comes back within the first 2 years, it's going to be a little harder to treat and to conquer, if you to use a military metaphor. But in my case, just to let readers know so they don't sit at the edge of their seats, mine has not come back in more than 5 years. But you don't know that when you're going through it, you know.
Yes, I see.
You're just sort of counting down the months.
Right, right. So, Elizabeth, on the bigger level here, you know, part of our mind thinks we're immortal, right? We're going to live forever. The other part realizes, well, everyone has died, right? All the greatest people in the history of the world, the smartest, the most beautiful, the richest, you know, influential, all died. So we realize that, but the other part of our mind doesn't realize that. And then the idea is like you're falling backwards into an abyss, let's say, psychologically, when you get something like this, right? Diagnosis, you know, right. Everything in my life that was and is or will be over. So some people turn to, you know, spiritual or some higher nature or something like that. And I know your sister talked about chanting and you think you tried it, but it didn't work for you. Did you have any spiritual path or any beliefs that would assist you in this?
The short answer is no, but the fuller answer is that my friends and family were my spiritual path, if you will, or my spiritual support, not path. And I have a very large, interesting group of friends, a good number of whom have survived cancer. And so I counted on them and I relied on them and I took a lot of comfort from them. And so they were kind of my higher power, if you will. I think you do. When Christopher Hitchens, famous atheist Christopher Hitchens, got cancer, a lot of people said to him, "Oh, so now I bet you're going to believe in God now, huh?" And he said, "No, actually." So I sort of wondered that myself. I mean, I wondered if I would turn to religion. I have a religion, but I'm not an observant person.
What is your religion?
I'm Jewish, okay. But I'm not. I don't celebrate, you know, Jewish holidays or anything.
Right. You know, at Love University, our motto is love is actually the fundamental force. You know, the spiritual force. Many religions, mm-hmm. you know, look at this as kind of the essence. So we talk about your family. I mean, that is love, right? You have love from them and to them. And if you do pass away, you know, at some point, the love will remain, you know, in their hearts and minds, right? So they'll remember you and you can pass that along. So I think that could be considered a spiritual legacy, for example, or love legacy that you leave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, the love of my friends and family was critically important for me. Definitely. Absolutely.
And you also mentioned in your book the word gratitude. Now, we talk a lot about this at Love University. Gratitude, a lot of research shows, actually reduces depression and improves sleep. You know, keeping a gratitude journal, writing three things every day that you're grateful for. And that's also a spiritual component as well, that you're giving thanks to something beyond yourself. Maybe it is your friends or family or a higher power, whatever it is. Tell us about gratitude, even in the midst of this, you know, thing, the shocking, challenge. How did you use gratitude?
Well, I'm a longtime gratitude aficionado. Yes, I'm a graduate of Al-Anon, and where I learned how to practice gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I spent, as a friend of mine said, you know, I just had 4,000 Al-Anon meetings. I don't think I had 4,000, but I had enough to get the program.
So you had a previous spouse or someone that was an alcoholic?
A family member, not a spouse, but a family member. Right. And so I was very attuned to gratitude as a critical life force.
Right.
And I, when I was doing my Al-Anon thing, I would just sometimes have to stop and write down what I was grateful for because things seemed very dark, and it always helped me. So I don't feel that I had to, quote, learn gratitude when I got cancer. I think I already knew gratitude. But And I always feel extremely grateful for all the good things in my life. I'm very, very aware of that. And I feel I have a lot to be grateful for. And I do remind myself of that regularly.
Yes.
And so that wasn't so hard. At the same time, I knew a lot of cancer patients who were friends and people I didn't know so well, who had a much worse time than I did. I have a partner. I have a job that I don't have to show up for. I work from home. I have enough money so that I did not become destitute. One of the things I write about in the book is my fear that if my illness went on and on, I could have a lot of financial problems. But for the limited time that I was sick, I did not. Again, I know there are millions of people not in that situation. And so I feel I had a lot to be grateful for amidst the diagnosis. I also had health insurance, and I live in the city that's considered a medical capital. And so I'm very aware of what I have to be grateful for. And I like to say that I don't take it for granted, because I know not everyone has these things. I'm not wealthy, and I'm not, I don't drive around in limousines. But I am very grateful for what I have.
Yeah, that's very powerful. You know, another exercise, Elizabeth, we often do in psychology is the meditation of your deathbed. You're lying on your deathbed, you look back, have I accomplished everything in life? What's my feeling? Regrets, things like that. Did you ever think about that? I mean, if your life were to be over, how would you feel about it?
I have to say, that's not very attractive. That's not something I gravitate to.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, but let's rephrase that. What are the things you're fulfilled about in your life? Let's look at it that way. The things that.
Well, let me just give you a sort of a footnote to that.
Okay.
I was in the hospital for 6 days getting chemo, and because of this weird gene I had. And so even though most people who have the kind of lymphoma I had do not have to be hospitalized, you just go to the doctor's office, because of this gene, I was in the hospital. And because of the kind of chemo I needed, it needed to be continuous, day and night. And one of my roommates was a young woman who came in, and I write about this in the book. She came into, one roommate left and another roommate came in at about 3 a.m. and she had leukemia. And I heard everything about her situation, because there were no walls, there was just a curtain. And I heard everything about her situation. And I saw she had young children, and the doctor gave her all this information about her condition, and he said, "Do you have any questions?" And she didn't speak English, so everything was Spanish and then translated into English. And he said, "Do you have any questions?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "What is it?" And he said, "Can my children visit me?" And when I saw this woman, I saw how young she was, and I said to myself, I am so grateful that, it's a little bit like your deathbed thing. Mm. I am much older than that. She has young children. I have gotten to do pretty much what I wanted to do with my life. I don't want it to end just yet. But compared to this woman, I've lived a long life. And so I felt very... it's sort of like, I want to say grateful, but something else. I felt like I'd gotten the chance to live a real life. And I didn't look back with a lot of regrets, compared to this woman.
I guess, right? I can say blessed or something else, you know, that come to you, right? A beautiful gift. Actually, I say a gift. So you've been given a gift in life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing is, also you brought up interesting issues. People ask, where does cancer come from? And you mentioned Susan Sontag talked about in her book, metaphors. For example, people that emotionally repress themselves, you know, get cancer, or their personality indicates that. And yeah, that's not really an accurate way to look at it. And then you also mentioned something about black dyes, dyeing your hair black can give you cancer. And then people think, you know, genetically it's transmitted through the generation. So what's your take on that, these kind of ideas?
Well, I'm not a doctor and I'm not a scientist. The idea that you have a cancer personality, I was not endorsing that. I was talking about Susan Sontag mentioning it. Right. And it was spoken about in the 1970s and probably earlier, because people didn't know a lot about cancer. And so it was sort of like, let's say an old wives' tale, or just something you could pull out of the sky. I do not endorse that. Cancer comes from a lot of places. I mean, if you live in the Love Canal, or if you work for Monsanto, or if you work for any number, if you made Agent Orange, or you were exposed to Agent Orange, I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cancer, carcinogenic products and chemicals and life situations. So it comes.
Does dyeing your hair black, does that make you, I think you said, was it Jackie O that dyed her hair black?
Well, I write a lot about this in the book. There's a lot of information about hair dye and cancer, and anyone listening can Google the subject. You can go to the American Cancer Society website and read their pages on hair dye. You can go to the NIH and see the studies they've done on hair dye and also on hair relaxers, which African Americans, mostly women, but also men, use and have used for generations, and children use those too. There is a great deal of information about chemical relaxers and hair dye online. There is much more definitive information about chemical relaxers than hair dye, as far as them being carcinogenic.
Right.
I am not going to issue a blanket statement, because there are no blanket statements.
Right.
It's a subject that there's a lot of money in hair dye, and there's also a lot of money in advertising and promoting hair dye.
Right.
And my own belief is that magazines, women's magazines, and popular magazines, and don't promote the dangers of hair dye, because they get a lot of money from companies. So, but there is a great deal of information. And the bottom line, as I understand it, is that darker permanent hair dyes are more dangerous than lighter temporary hair dyes. And there's a consensus around that.
Okay. Everyone's going to be turning blonde now, I guess, because of this.
Yeah. So I urge people to, and there's also a friend of mine wrote a book called True Roots, Ronnie Citron Fink, True Roots, about the environmental dangers of hair dye for hairdressers who are exposed to it all day long, all day and all night, who do have high incidences of cancer, and also the environment, because the hair dye goes into the water system, the water supply, and so it's actually a pretty serious, complicated subject.
A lot of correlational studies, but you know, the causation, that's the tricky part. Now, the other thing you mentioned, actually, I like the way your book lays out a lot of interesting questions. You talk about, is there a gendered response to illness? And you mentioned, when you told your husband, he was very calm, you know, men maybe a little more stoic. And women, you said, worry more about their bodies. On the other hand, men die earlier, and maybe they don't get checked up as much. They don't, you know, get those colonoscopies or other things that women do. So is there a difference in gender in terms of illness and reaction to it among men and women?
Well, there are a lot of studies that show men go to the doctor less often than women do.
Right.
Men there are all kinds of sex-linked studies. Men take out anxieties on other people and violence on other people, whereas women tend to take it out on themselves. Women go to doctors more often because they have more body parts that are examined all the time, and men tend to dismiss symptoms and say, "Oh, I don't need to do anything." And there are a lot of studies asserting this.
Right. But do you freak out and your husband was calm? Is that the way it worked?
Yes. Well, my husband is extremely calm anyway. My husband is calm about all kinds of things. The only thing he's not calm about is being late to dinner.
Oh, okay.
And then he gets very frantic. Hmm. But so he's an exceptionally calm person, which is sometimes good, but sometimes very annoying.
Oh, okay.
But for
catastrophes and dangers, he's probably good because he can handle it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it cuts both ways. Because being anxious can be very debilitating, but it can also make you alert to danger.
Right.
And that's what government agencies do when they're working is they alert you to the dangers out there.
Right.
Like
your credit card is being fraudulently used.
Like COVID, right?
Oh, yeah.
If Obama had been president, we would have had a different COVID experience because he would have been paying attention to the dangers out there instead of ignoring them. Okay, and that's the same way that nervous people deal with anxiety. They're alert to danger, and sometimes my darling husband, whom I love to death, is not as alert to danger as I am.
You're a yin and yang, right? You're a good combination.
Yeah, we're great.
He's a calmer
together.
Down. Exactly.
We're great together, yeah.
Now, one thing you mentioned is you ask, why doesn't illness seem more in literature's great subjects? And I think you said, Virginia Woolf said, illness is not taking the place of love, battle, and jealousy and all that. But I was thinking there have been movies about it that won Academy Awards in Philadelphia with AIDS. You remember Tom Hanks and...
Yeah.
The recent one, Dallas Buyers Club. And also, I think Patch Adams was Robin Williams. But I noticed they're all like men. I haven't seen too many women illness movies or books. Are there any out there?
Well, oh, sure. No. Now, Virginia Woolf said that in 1930.
Ah, okay. Things have changed.
And I clarify this in the book. I say, in 1930, when she said that, it was very different. Illnesses killed us pretty quickly. And in the 100 years since then, it's really changed.
Right.
And so there is a lot of writing about illness now.
Okay.
There's a great deal. One of the movies about women and illness is, what was it called? It's a Larry McMurtry book. It was with Shirley MacLaine and Deborah Winger and Jack Nicholson. But that was from about 30 years ago.
Okay.
But there's a lot of, there's a wonderful play called Wit that I think won a Pulitzer Prize about a woman lying in bed dying of cancer. And she was a literature professor. And she talks about poetry as she's dealing with her cancer. There's a lot written. In 1930, there wasn't. But nowadays, there's a great deal about illness.
That could be helpful, I guess, to tell people. Now, the other thing is, on a personal level, you mentioned something about it being a mother would have changed your, I guess, hypochondriac, also your writing. And you said something about you were going to adopt a child and you didn't do it. What happened with that? You weren't able to adopt a child?
I was married before this husband to another husband, and my husband and I were going to adopt a child from Vietnam. And we were sort of embarked on this project, and I kind of realized that my husband had some emotional problems that made it that I had kind of an epiphany that my husband's emotional problems would not make this a good idea. And I kind of backed out. And we were going to adopt.
Would you have been a better writer or not a hypochondriac if you had a child?
Well, I don't say that I would have. I'm not great on blanket statements. I'm not a big, but I think I asked the question. I wonder if I would have been less of a hypochondriac. I wonder, the only thing I kind of will say for sure is that if I had found my lump in my arm and gotten diagnosed and treated right away, I probably wouldn't have written a book. That's something that I think is probably pretty clear, because mm-hmm. The whole thing would have been over. But mm-hmm. because I went through all this craziness for so long, I had things to write about. But as far as being a mother and being a writer, a lot of writers, women writers, I don't know how to put this. I don't want to say they're reluctant, but many women writers are reluctant to have kids because they know how much energy both the writing and the kids take.
Right. Well, it takes away time, but it gives love. So it's a balancing, right? The key is if the inspiration, because a lot of people dedicate to their children, you know, things they do. But then again, it takes a lot of time and energy. So you think they would have balanced out in some way?
Well, for some people it does. And some people, decide that they don't want that they can't deal with that. And I think, even though I waited for a long time to have children, because I kept waiting for a time when I felt I would be able to keep writing and have a kid, and probably waited too long. But then when I did have this child I was going to adopt, I realized it wasn't a good thing for the child. And it was interesting. I was going to adopt a child from Vietnam. And for many decades, I didn't go to Vietnam because I didn't go as a tourist, because I was afraid that it remind me of this kid that I didn't adopt. And then one of the things I did after I had cancer was I went to Vietnam with a friend. Hmm. So I write about that in the book, about that phenomenon.
I see. Now, in terms of, I think of a practical issue here when it comes to illness, you say, should I talk about it, you know, either to people or even join groups and, you know, like get it out there, or should I be quiet and private? I think you mentioned one of the producers, Nora Ephron, was very private. And then you said you got power from you being private. So how did that work out? Is it better to talk about it and, you know, join groups or be quiet about this, if diagnosis of this cancer?
Well, I don't give advice to people about this. My only advice is you do what you feel comfortable doing.
Right. But your case, you were quiet.
Did you? I was quiet. I did tell a good number of people that I was in contact with regularly, for sort of obvious reasons. You know, if they said, can we do something? And I couldn't. Right. I didn't tell anyone in my building with whom I'm in contact. My basic, sort of strategy was to keep it as quiet as possible. And I didn't do anything on social media, and I didn't share with a lot of people, but I did. And this was 5 or 6 years ago. And I think it's, you know, I think Nora Ephron told no one. Mm. I told my close friends, but she told no one. Mm-hmm. And when she died, people said, maybe we weren't such good friends. You know, like I would have told someone, I would have told her, right, not knowing what they would have done.
You said it kind of spooks people, you know, people get uncomfortable with it. And also you said you retain power by not saying it. It's a power.
It's a little bit like an anorexic. A lot of times anorexics, the only thing they feel they can control is how much food they eat. And this is their way to maintain control. It's an illusion, right? Because you're hurting yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may be true that you maintain power, but you're hurting yourself by having that kind of control. It gave me the illusion that I had some power, because when you're a cancer patient, you feel you don't have a lot of power. So it was one thing that I could control. And so it wasn't like it made me feel powerful and great. It it was the only thing that I really could control. And I said to friends of mine, don't ask me how I am. I don't want, just don't ask.
Right.
So I sort of, and in a certain way, that was a way of maintaining some power. I didn't want to be barraged with questions about how I was.
Right. Exactly.
So I guess what I would say is, just to somebody who's going through this, that you have to tell people what you need. You have to tell people what's going to make things easier for you. And sometimes it's not talking about it. Sometimes it's making them food. Sometimes it's walking their dog. But it was, as I say, it was not that I felt powerful by not talking about it, but it was also, but it just gave me a little bit of feeling of having a little bit of power.
Exactly. I see. Now, the philosophical question you ask, I think, toward the end is, which is worse, the fear of knowing or the fear of not knowing? And you know the term ignorance is bliss, right? So if I push it out of my head, I'm not going to worry about it. Like even death, right? There are people that avoid thinking about death. Other people think about it all the time and, you know, getting older and unhealthy. And you said it's kind of a balance. You want to be prepared, but you also want to have a little bit of lightness in your mind. So how do you personally feel about that?
I don't have a final answer. I think yes. It's always a balance. I think it's I'm just aware, and I think it's both answers, but both situations are frightening. I guess I would like doctors to find some new ways to talk to people about being sick, because they did a very poor job of it with me for the most part.
Right.
And so they put me off. They said they didn't think I had cancer when it was, they thought I had cancer. And so I was really posing some of those questions as things for doctors to think about.
Right.
And it turns out that Atul Gawande wrote a book, I think it's called On Mortality, and he said that doctors have very, very little training in talking about death and dying. They have a lot of training in, you know, chemo and life extending procedures, but not in that mushy area of talking to people about making choices that may not extend their life. And so I saw that even though I was really angry at these doctors because they were so mealy-mouthed and imprecise with me, I saw that they didn't really know how to do it either.
Right, that makes sense. I want to ask you something. Have you ever heard of this is called the Virginia Compassionate Initiative? Which is actually University of Virginia, actually in their nursing program, they actually train medical workers to be more compassionate, and they begin by doing mindfulness and journaling and breathing and all that, even yoga, and then they transmit that to the patients, and they actually see a lot more recovery improvement, and also the workers feel better themselves, more satisfied. So I wonder if we could do that with doctors, or even in, medical in general. What do you think of that?
Well, I can see that the only person who talked to me about anything at all, non-medical, was an intake nurse at Mount Sinai who said, she said, I have cancer too. And every Saturday I go to this guy in Flushing who helps me, and you should go there too.
Sure.
Doctors don't go in for that. That's a bit because it's not science. They just don't. It's
because
like
they benefit from it. What if you created a doctor's compassionate program that was almost mandatory in medical school? You think
it would be great, but good luck with that. I'm in favor of it, but it's sort of antithetical to medical practice. At the same time, at Harvard, there is a complementary medicine component at the Harvard Medical School, as far as I know. So Harvard is sort of introducing this, but my sense of things is that medicine, you know, the science-y part of medicine is right. not just predominates, but, you know, rules. But at the same time, Jerome Groopman, well-known, I think he's an oncologist at Beth Israel Harvard. He wrote a book called The Anatomy of Hope. Oh. And so it's a little woo-woo for a Harvard doctor to write about hope. But he says, if you sort of practice hope, if you will, you do better. I think some doctors are a little more open to this stuff, but I think nurses and others are much more open-minded about this.
I think, you know, as society progresses with research, you know, the idea of emotional intelligence is now being, you know, shown in business corporations. People thought, we're not going to talk about emotions in business, but actually it's been very helpful. So maybe that could be a future trend.
I think it is a trend here and there.
Can be. That'd be nice. Because, you know, we know mood contagion is you pick up the moods of people around you. So if a doctor's in a certain way, you're going to maybe pick it up. But if they're more compassionate and caring, then you might pick that up psychologically and might affect you emotionally and physically. And the other thing is, Roy talked about the libido, life instinct, and the death instinct. So now, libido, you talk about sex. Why do you like to write about sex? Yeah, so you're one of the experts in this area.
I wrote a book that came out in 1996, which is 30 years ago. I was asked to write this book by a publisher. I was asked to write a book called The Joy of Writing Sex. And I wrote about sex in my fiction, and this publisher thought I would, and I taught writing, and this publisher thought I would be a good match for an idea she had for a book called The Joy of Writing Sex. And so I sort of came to be associated with that. And I wrote a book in 1996, came out, and it got a huge amount of attention, and it became kind of the first book about writing about sex in fiction. And but it was really about good writing and about applying the principles of good writing fiction to sex.
I see.
And by 2001, we'd had the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and we had the internet. So that was like 1998.
Okay. Maybe you need to update it to 2024, the book.
Well, I actually updated the book in 2002.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So the book that people buy now was updated in 2002. I looked at it the other night for another project I'm working on, and I think it could use another update. I don't know if I'm the right person to do it.
Okay.
But I basically was applying the rules of good writing, as I say, to sex scenes, and helping people and diffusing a lot of the fear and uncertainty that people had about how to write a sex scene, dealing with things like, what if my mother reads this? What if my husband reads this? What if my kids read this? Those are like the emotional things. But then how do you write about this without it just being a... like a pornographic story. And so I tried to break things down and show people examples of how really interesting, smart literary writers wrote about sex, including Toni Morrison and Philip Roth and James Salter. So I wasn't doing erotica or pornography.
Sure. So for a writer, you're very communicative, Elizabeth. I thought you might be...
For a writer?
What's that again? Yeah, writers are often talking, because we're often internal energy writers, and some writers are more external. Are you more of an internal or external energy person, you say?
I hope I'm both. I mean, I teach writing. I'm a writing coach.
Okay.
So I have to communicate pretty well. Most of the writers I know can talk.
Yeah, but then they get tired. I mean, introvert, we can talk, but then we need to recharge our batteries and take a hot tub or something like that. So that's a different...
Well, recharging. I can do that too. Yeah. I do spend most of the day by myself, but...
There you go. Okay. But you can talk when you need to.
Yeah, I do. And I also, you know, I do a lot of writing. I coach kids in applying to college. So I sometimes talk for 12 hours a day.
Elizabeth, now that you have, I guess, overcome this illness and you're obviously a very accomplished author, are there any projects you're working on? Anything our listeners would want to hear about you or even your website? We want to know more about you.
Well, I have a lot of, I'm starting to write something new now. So if it turns into something, it's not going to be around, it's not going to be available for quite some time. But I do have a lot of essays. I have 8 books that people can read. I edited 3 anthologies that I'm very proud of. One of them is called Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, and where writers write about people who change their lives. And that's a book that people in writing programs really like.
I like the alliteration. Mentors.
Mentors, Muses, and Monsters. 30 writers on the people who changed their lives.
Nice. I like that. And where can people hear about you? Do you have a website or anything else?
My website is my name, elizabethbenedict.com.
Okay. And do you do coaching or tell us anything else that you work on?
Well, I have a business helping kids apply to college and particularly help them with their college essays.
Oh, wow. Great.
And I spend half the year doing that. And I have a lot of essays. I've written a lot of personal essays and literary and sexual politics essays, which are all on my website. And I recently, I'm very happy about this. I recently did the audiobook for my new book, Rewriting Illness, that we've been talking about. Yeah. And so you can get that on Audible. And it's 6 hours. And one thing we didn't talk about that I want people to know is that my book, even though it sounds kind of weird to say it, my book is funny.
I was going to say that. You said poignant humor, I think, the term you use in there.
I'm not sure. It's funny in the way that life can be funny, but it's not a grim book about cancer. Yeah. And a lot of people are surprised that they say I wasn't prepared for it to be entertaining, but it was
lighthearted in certain areas.
Yeah. Well, I make fun of myself a lot. Because of my hypochondria. And I find the humor in a lot of things. But so I just want to sort of alert people to, even though it is about this sort of encounter with cancer, I have enough it's sort of tragedy plus time equals comedy. And it's not a comedy, but it may not be as difficult to read as people think.
I would say it's smaller chapters. It's kind of readable. It's pleasant. So Elizabeth, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I mean, you're a great inspiration. I know people are going to learn a lot from this show today about illness and, like you said, gratitude and transcending it, love of the family, and having that attitude that I can survive, right? And I made it, and I'm going to do more in my life. So thank you very much, Elizabeth. And hopefully, if you have another book or something else, we'd love to have you back on again. Love University.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Really, it's been fun to talk to you.
Dr. Alex Avila, Love University. If you want to reach us and talk about today's show, you can reach us at loveuniversity.love. Call us at 310-226-8090. Write to us at loveuniversitylove@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Dr. Alex Avila. Put away your notebooks, your iPads, your phones, and our guest professor will say adieu to her as well. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
That was really an inspiring interview with Elizabeth, who is an acclaimed writer, author, public speaker, and professor, Elizabeth Benedict. So she taught us that you can really survive, you know, these catastrophic illness diagnoses, psychologically and physically, but mainly psychologically. And she talked about love, the love of her family, gratitude, being grateful for everything that you have, and also realizing that you can survive and you can thrive in the most adverse circumstances. And that's really our motto at Love University. It's to love yourself, others, and a higher nature, because that is the power of love. The love legacy you leave behind when you do pass away. Love legacy when you are alive and can still contribute through your don, which we call the higher talent. It comes from the word don divino, your gift, whether it's writing, teaching, speaking, science, business, technology, taking care of people, working with your hands. Whatever that talent is, utilize it with love to make a difference in the world. So again, this is Dr. Alex Avila. If you want to get a hold of us, you can contact us at loveuniversitylove@gmail.com. Call us at 310-226-8090. You can download the podcast on on Podbean, Spotify, SoundCloud, and iTunes. You can like and follow us on Facebook at Love University Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Love Letter U Podcast. Visit us and subscribe to our Love University YouTube channel. So until next time, this is Dr. Alex Avila. Put away your notebooks, your iPads, your phones. Class is now dismissed. Love yourself, others, and the higher. Until next time.